Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is August the 21st, 2025, and this is episode, 3,726 of the Survival Podcast. And it's a Thursday, that means it's time for an expert counsel Q&A show of the week. And if this is your favorite show of the week, bathe in it. Take it all in, because for the next 2 weeks, you won't have one. Nothing's wrong with the expert counsel, though it is piker season, so I did fire off an email today saying, hey, you guys have 2 weeks off, now work harder. Because I'm down to, the only content that I have right now in the bank is from Andy McCann, who has a ridiculous work ethic, and he's pretty much good until about Thanksgiving with what I have in the bank. I have nothing from anybody else. I don't have Andy on today because I have so much content from him. He's on often, so I figured we'd hear from all the other folks that we don't always hear from as often. But you can help me shake the piker tree. How do you do that? Send me a question for an expert council member. Send that question to Jack at thesurvivalpodcast.com. And when you do that, put in the subject line TSPC expert, whatever, you know, TSP expert question or whatever. And then today, Jack, my question is for expert council member, fill in the blank. Don't put fill in the blank. Put their name. Tell me who it's for. If you think more than one person should answer it, tell me that too. You know, it's for John Pugliano, or it's for Nick Ferguson and Jeff Lawton. Like, stuff like that happens. All right. Then hit return. So there's a space in there. Give me your question in one sentence with a question mark. Then hit return again, put a space in it, so it's not a block of text that me and my one eye can't read well, and then give me all the details you think we need. But just distill your question into, in fact, a question. If you have five questions, send five different emails. Trust me, bro, it works better that way. I've been doing this for 17 years. You can trust me on this. Send that to me, I'll get it over to the expert, and that will help shake the piker tree. But why will I be gone? As I've said, I'm going on a ship, a giant, glorious ship, a luxury ship in the luxury section. I haven't luxuried myself in a very long time, and I need it. So I'm going to tell you something else. There may not even be rewinds while I'm gone. I have a feeling there'll be something for you Thursday and Friday next week, but the following week, I may just not be here. I used to do that all the time. I got to where I really didn't like leaving the show, not having any new content or anything coming out for that long. But right now, I need a break. I'm going to be honest with you guys. I need a break. Everybody needs a break. You know, we didn't take a vacation last year. And I'm like, oh, man, I don't mean it like, oh, God, we didn't have money or whatever. I don't mean it that. I just, guys, when you do what I do every day, and you've done it for this long, two decades almost, there's times where you just need kind of like, I need new creativity. I don't want to just keep recycling the same stuff we've done for 17 years. I'm not an AM radio host, for God's sakes, where I just say the same thing every day, and after listening to five of my shows, anybody with a good memory could fill in for me. I like to keep bringing you diversity, new content, new material, and not leaning on the crutch of, let's talk about the news. And to do that every once in a while, my brain needs, just like your computer, a complete shutdown, boom, and then like, and then booting back up. And that's what vacations do for us. One of my laws of life is you are a battery. And batteries need recharging and maintenance. And a big part of that battery that is you is that brain of yours. So you should take your vacations too and do that with them. And when I'm gone, don't email me about anything really important because I'm not going to answer you. I'm going to delete it. And it, don't email me and say, but I live in Fairbanks. Let's have dinner. No, I'm having dinner with my wife. All right. That happens all the time, too. I'm going to this place. Okay. Well, yeah. Why don't we have a meetup? No. Wife time. That's what this is. And that's my advice to you men. You hard charging, hard working guys. Yeah, do that. You got to work 60 hours a week to take care of your family. Do that. When you shut down and go away, go away. Nothing will die because you're not there. Somebody will fix it. Let them deal with it. That way they'll appreciate you more when you come back if you have a J-O-B, by the way. All right, with that, what are we going to be talking about today? Bunch of stuff. Ron Paul and Chris Rossini will say Trump said he'd end the UK war on day one. It's now day 211. I'll have a little follow-up on that one. Chef Ken Daniels will be talking about the Merlot steak. Steak, not the wine. Merlot steak. No Merlot. But you might even hear from a anonymous caller today about Merlot. Maybe two of them. I don't know. But we're going to talk about the Merlot steak in Ken's new series on underrated beef cuts. Jeff Lawton will talk about establishing a new farm with sandy soils, and I will apologize in advance. There is, Jeff does this like he's the guy that works 80 hours a week, and he's always got students in and out, and he's always in the different permaculture research institutes. There's a crying baby for part of this one. It's a bit distracting, but it is what it is. John Pugliano will talk about new movement in the nuclear power market and investing in those markets. And I'll let you know that John and another member of the community will be on together after I get back. I think it's like right after I get back, the first week or the second week, specifically talking about nuclear energy making a renaissance in America. That's not really what this is specifically about, but it's tied to it. The only reason we haven't had that show yet is the other person became unavailable on the day we had him booked. That's why we had John on a couple weeks ago as a standalone on a different subject, because we want to bring both of them in, because this other gentleman works directly in the nuclear industry. His name is Dylan, and we will have the two of them on. But today, John's going to be talking about the investment opportunities there. Matt Sersley is going to talk about something in the big, beautiful bill, and I'm all for tax deductions. And I saw this one, and I said, well, self, that's nice if you're Procter & Gamble or a drug company or something like that, but this can't possibly help me and my peeps. An R&D deduction, right? And it's something you would expense anyway, but then you get to multiply the expense and expense the expense greater because you call it R&D. Now, look, I'm all for working the shit out of the tax code. I really am. Like, I will work that bitch over. I've said over and over again, 95% of the tax code is how you get out of it. 5% is what you have to do, right? And focus on the 95%. But I also like, you know, calling something something else, be very careful there. That's where they, you know, ream you in the butt. However, Matthew put this in perspective, and I think maybe I need to do some R&D in 2026. This won't help you with this year's taxes because the new tax stuff doesn't kick in until end of year as we start the next tax year. But this is a legit way to not just create a new expense, but magnify existing ones. And that is really working the system. Doc Bones will talk about something called road rash. What you do for self-care, and what you should have on hand in case you have to do it. I'll tell you guys a little, well, it's not really little, but the road rash itself was little. An accident I was in when I was a teenager was pretty shitty, and I learned something about road rash. Road rash is transferable, not from human to human, but from road, through material, through other material, through additional material, to you, and you can still get it, and it can still be pretty deep and harsh. Because burn is, it really is more of a burn than an abrasion in many ways. And next, man, I've been telling you guys that they've been lying about Ukraine. This will bookend well with Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini's segment on ending the war. I've told you that the losses were far greater in the Ukraine than the Ukrainians were admitting to. That even what the Russians were telling us, the Ukrainians were lying about. Well, this did come from RT, but it has been confirmed by an MP out of Ukraine. An MP is not a military police officer, member of parliament, supposed to be like one of our congressional representatives or senators in our country. This is legit. Okay, so, but the source is Russia Today. I don't care, right? When the source in Russia Today is providing the documents themselves, where they came from, and a member of the Ukrainian parliament saying, yeah, this is legit. 1.7 million Ukrainians, almost all men, dead. 1.7 million gone. Fathers that will never be there for their children. Some of them grandfathers that will never be there for their children. Probably the majority, though, age about 22, because that's the age of conscription in Ukraine, to about 40. The prime of your society. If you adjust for Ukraine's population, it would be over 14 million young men killed in America. 14 million, based on our population versus their populations. Not that big a country. And then you would narrow it down into the primary demographic of the men who serve, being your future. I mean, it's one thing to lose 14 million men in America, but imagine losing 14 million men between the age of, you know, at our conscription age being 18 to 40. That's your fathers. That's your construction workers. That's your office managers. That's your uncles. Those are the men that are supposed to be around to raise the next generation of young boys into men. The ones that are supposed to be there to take care of wives, to look after elders, to become elders, and to advise that next generation of men after they've helped raise them into men to then advise them as senior elders. Gone. I didn't do the research. Maybe I will while we're listening to the other experts. I wonder how many men in America there are in that demographic, let's say 18 to 40. I'll get that information while we listen to the others. I think if you've been on the fence about whether or not this war just needs to freaking end however it freaking has to be for it to end, and this doesn't get through to you, you don't care about human life. You don't care about human life. With that in mind, let's hear from Ron Paul and Chris Rossini on the Ukraine war.
On one positive note, we'll give him some credit. President Trump speaking with Putin and having these meetings is a good thing in and of itself. Biden wouldn't talk to Putin. We remember that. But we can't forget that Donald Trump campaigned to get this done on day one, and that's what everybody wanted. It's now day 211. And, you know, this is now, he keeps calling it Biden's war, but after 211 days, and you still have not gotten America out of this by just walking out of it, it becomes your war too, President Trump. So it's no more money, no more weapons. And you can't say NATO, 70% of what they spend comes from our tax money. It's, you know, Ukraine, he also says Zelensky could stop this at any moment. Zelensky is the proxy. It's a very shameful thing that happened, that they're the proxy of a war between America and Russia. And they took the brunt of it so that there's no direct conflict with nuclear powers. It is President Trump that could put this, right as we speak, he could put an end to it. So this has now gone 211 days into his administration. It should have never started, as Dr. Paul mentioned, but it doesn't have to continue past this day. And President Trump is continuing it. So hopefully now, like we said, the positive is that they're talking. Now get it done and get us out of this losing war.
Freedom is the answer. Freedom is easy. Freedom is popular. We used to know what it was like. And today we hear bits and pieces of it and people get excited about it. But we still have a long way to go because I think the cleansing of the system is going to be a lot more difficult than most people believe. And that is why I think the march to bankruptcy is going to continue. And unfortunately, the bankruptcy involves financial, which is devastating to just about everybody, and then it's also going to be a moral bankruptcy, and that's a little more difficult to handle, but that is something that will make all the difference in the world, and I think people have to know and understand and endorse the principle of natural law, because that's been known to be before printing presses were around, before they even knew about it, and governments had devised a system which they believed would help. No lying and no cheating, no stealing and no killing. And a lot of people still believe that, but what they don't understand is they're allowing the government to do it. They lie to us all the time, and they cheat and steal, and they manipulate us. So, but I think, in spite of it all, I think the interest in a free society is growing by leaps and bounds, but it's going to take a lot of work, but it takes a lot more education for the people.
So I have to tell you, I've said before that I'm less disappointed in Donald Trump than many people in the liberty movement, Ukrainians, and even real Republicans, right? Not Republican government people, but your hardworking, everyday, you know, blue-collar, small government-focused Republican person, and your centrist Democrats that came across the aisle and voted for the Orange Man. In fact, I've become aware of a lot of people that voted for the Orange Man this time that I would have never thought had in the past couple months, because since they're upset and they're disappointed, they're complaining about the fact that they did, and otherwise I wouldn't have known. But this is one of the few places I'm actually disappointed. The reason I wasn't disappointed is I didn't expect as much. But I did think, based on what I know of Trump, and this is something I'm going to tell you about Trump, and if you don't agree with it, and if it makes you mad, and you don't think it's true, then either, well, I'm just going to say somehow you have been misled, and somehow you have chosen to believe the people who have misled you. Trump hates death. Trump hates seeing people die. Trump is the peace president. That doesn't mean he's effective at it all the time, but he is the peace president in that he actually cares that people are dying in this place, no matter which side they're on. He doesn't want to see people die. That is who he is. That is a personality trait of the man. This is very different than anybody in my life who's been president. Bill Clinton gave a fuck if people died. Neither did George Bush. Neither did Obama. Biden didn't know it, but when he did know it, when he was VP, he didn't care. When he was a senator for 40 years, he didn't give a shit. Reagan didn't care if people died. Now, they might have cared if Americans died, but they didn't give a shit who died anywhere else. And their actions and their words show that to be the case. Trump actually doesn't want people to die. He wants this to stop. That's why this week, when he had all the Eurotards in the White House, and he said, hey, we got to get this done, and one of them said, hey, why don't we meet again in a couple months? He said, are you nuts? There are 40,000 people a month are going to die. It might be more than that, all right, save for my segment. And so he made a call to Putin right away. The press has to find something wrong, right? Why didn't you do it with all the Europeans and Zelensky on speakerphone? You shut up, you mind-numbingly stupid person. But I agree with Chris and Ron's assertion. If the United States had just said, no more weapons, no more money, this war would have been over by now. However, there are things that a president knows and a president's cabinet knows that we don't know. And you can't completely judge that from the outside. I'll also tell you something else that I absolutely know about Trump. And my history with Trump is way pre his political history. I won't get into it today, but I've actually worked as a consultant for one of Trump's companies. And so I know more about the man than the average person on the street does. I don't know what his favorite color is or whatever, but I know certain things about the guy. And one of them is, and this is a weakness, he is very susceptible to the last person to talk to him. He is the guy that, because he doesn't want people to die, and because he's led by emotion, you can be deceived when you're that person. That's one of the, it's a good thing and a bad thing, and that's one of those things. So he could also be being misled by the people he trusts. Now, I think he's done a lot better of figuring out who to trust and who not to trust than his first term, but it sure as hell is far from perfect. So I'm more lenient, I guess, than Ron and Chris are here in that I don't know what he knows about what would happen if we just completely wiped our hands and walked away. And I don't know what fears he might have of that. Maybe he believes the bullshit that Putin wants to reconstitute the USSR, and that if we just walked out, he would take all of Ukraine, and then he's going to take all of Europe. Now, this is stupid. I call it Schrodinger's Putin. And here's what I mean. You know Schrodinger's cat? You put the cat in a box, and there's a vial of poison with a timer that's going to make the poison release. But until you open the box, you don't know if it happens, so the cat can be both seen as dead and alive at the same time. So Putin is so weak, he's literally running out of bullets. They're repairing their tanks with washing machine parts. Yeah? Okay, sure. And he's on the verge of complete and total collapse, and his country hates him, and his people hates him, and he's a dictator, and he's an idiot, and he's a madman. Okay, that's the stage set, and that's why if we keep funding Ukraine, they can win the war. However, if he wins the war in Ukraine, he'll take all of Europe. Do you see how absolutely asinine, stupid that is? You're expected to believe that, and the worst thing is many people do. This is a complex situation. But as I've said, I think we're on the road to peace. The other thing I keep hearing, though, is we're supposed to be on the road to peace, but Putin keeps bombing things. It's a war, stupid, and so do the Ukrainians, and that's how wars work. Anyway, I'll save the rest of my thoughts on this for my segment. Let's talk about something much better. Let's talk about Merlot with Chef Ken Daniels. Oh, wait. There's that call I was expecting. An anonymous two people from this audience have called in. How did they even know I was recording right now? They have a comment about this.
Do not sabotage me. If you want to be a fucking lightweight, then that's your call, but do not sabotage me.
Oh, aye, aye, Captain, you got it.
And if they want to drink Merlot, we're drinking Merlot.
No, if anybody orders Merlot, I'm leaving. I am not drinking any fucking Merlot!
Okay, okay, relax, Miles. Jesus, no Merlot.
Oh, it's been a long time since I dropped pop culture on you that way. For those that don't know, that is from one of the most underrated movies of all time, in my opinion. It's a movie called Sideways, and wine does play a big part in it. It was a really great movie. Here's a funny little factoid about that before we hear from Ken on Merlot steak, not Merlot the wine. Merlot sales in the United States tanked when that movie was released. Here's the thing. The character in the movie that hates the Merlot, he doesn't hate the Merlot because he hates Merlot. He hates Merlot because it was his wife's favorite drink, his ex-wife's favorite wine to drink, and it makes him think of her. Anyway, let's hear about actual Merlot steak. Nothing to do with the wine, though. It would pair well.
Hello all, Chef Ken here. Welcome back to Lesser Known Beef Cut Series, where we dig into the unsung heroes of the butcher's case. Those cuts that quietly sit in the shadows of rib eyes and tenderloins, but absolutely deserve your attention. Today we're talking about the Merlot steak, and I'm going to be honest, some of my fellow chefs probably won't be thrilled that I'm telling you about this. This is one of those secret cuts that we chefs quietly love, something we keep in our back pocket because most people don't know to ask for it. And frankly, the more people know about these hidden gems, the more expensive they'll get. But here's the thing. I'm not about gatekeeping good food. You deserve to know about it. So today, you're in on the secret. Where exactly does the Merlot steak come from? This isn't a cut you're going to find in a standard beef diagram because it's not part of the traditional retail breakdown. The Merlot steak comes from the hind leg of the cow, specifically from the heel of the round, the same muscle group that gives us cuts like the eye of round and parts of the shank. Now that might sound surprising because when we think of the round, we think lean, tough, and generally destined for slow cooking or grinding, not quick cooked steaks. But hidden in that hard working section is this small cylindrical muscle that has a tight grain, very little connective tissue, and a surprising tenderness when handled correctly. Since becoming an apprentice butcher, I'm spending my time breaking down whole animals. This is one of those cuts that you develop a relationship with. You see where it lives, nestled in that heel area, often overlooked, just waiting for someone to give it a little respect. The truth is, most large-scale processors just leave the Merlot steak lumped into trim for grind or roast. Because it's small, it takes time to pull out, and it's not a recognized retail cut. But when you're butchering carefully, you see it, you can feel it, and once you know what it is, you won't want to let it go unnoticed again. So while the Merlot steak might seem like a mystery in the grocery store, it's not a mystery to butchers who work from whole animals. And that's exactly why it feels like a secret worth sharing. Let's talk about what makes the Merlot steak so appealing and why it's a favorite for chefs who know about it, even though they rarely talk about it. First, flavor. The Merlot steak is lean, make no mistake about that. But its flavor is dense and deeply beefy. It's often described as having a clean, almost mineral-forward profile, that kind of pure beef flavor that doesn't get weighed down by excessive fat but still carries intensity. It's a cut that's sometimes compared to a petite sirloin or even a flank steak, but that comparison doesn't quite do it justice. The Merlot steak has a finer grain and a texture that's more tender than you'd expect from something pulled from the round, and here's why chefs love it. It delivers that rich flavor experience without being heavy, and when prepared right, it cooks quickly and beautifully. Because it's so lean, the Merlot steak needs a little help when you cook it. You can't treat it like a ribeye or a New York strip that has natural marbling throughout. This is a cut that demands some external fat to help it shine. That might mean cooking it in a pan with beef tallow or pairing it with a compound butter after cooking. But one way or another, you want to introduce fat into the cooking process to amplify its flavor and keep the eating experience moist and luscious. This is why I always think of the Merlot steak as a cut that rewards simplicity and technique. Cook it properly and pair it with fat and you get this beautifully clean, flavorful bite that feels like something special. It's small, often around 6 to 8 ounces, so it's ideal for a quick meal when you want something satisfying but not overly heavy. I love serving it sliced thin across the grain with bright sauces like chimichurri or even just a knob of garlic herb butter melting over the top. Handled poorly, cooked too long, served dry, and it can feel a little disappointing, but when you treat it with care, when you understand what it is and what it isn't, it absolutely sings. So fat needs to be part of your plan, either in the pan or on the plate. My favorite way to cook the steak is in a cast iron skillet over high heat with plenty of fat in the pan, butter, tallow, or even duck fat if you're feeling indulgent. You want that pan hot enough to sear quickly and develop color, but because it's a lean cut, you don't want to blast it too long. Aim for a perfect medium rare, around 125 to 130 degrees internal temperature. Then rest it briefly. It's important to rest the steak because leaner cuts like this benefit from even redistribution of juices after cooking, and then slice thinly across the grain. Even though this steak is tender, slicing across the grain ensures every bite is as tender as possible. And this is where your sauce or finishing fat really matters. Dollop of butter melting over the top or a drizzle of olive oil and sea salt just before serving can elevate the experience dramatically. Now, where do you find the Merlot steak? Here's the thing. You're not going to walk into your typical grocery store and see a Merlot steak sitting in the packaged meat section. You'll need to ask your butcher. And chances are, you may even get a funny look because this is not a standardized retail cut. But any butcher who's breaking down whole animals will know exactly where this muscle lives. And they'll respect you for asking. You're showing that you care about more than just the obvious steaks, that you want to explore, that you appreciate the whole animal. And honestly, that's part of the joy of butchery, connecting with people who care enough to ask. So when you're ready for something different, something that feels like a little culinary secret, the Merlot steak is waiting for you. This is what this series is all about. Celebrating the cuts that deserve more love, the ones that chefs quietly keep to themselves because they know they're special. But I'm sharing them with you because good food shouldn't be a secret. More info can always be found at bloodsugarchef.com and drinkeatlearn.com. Keep those questions coming in. And until next time, this is Ken, the Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
This new farm in Yorkshire in England with the sandy soil. The first thing I would check is compaction. Probably isn't that compacted being sandy, but it's always worth a check because you may have to use chisel plow or an aerator, which is like a spader on a drum that just relieves the compaction. Then I would be looking at introducing compost tea into the rip lines or the spading, so that you get beneficial compost organisms directly into the soil. And you could use a seeder on the same operation if it was the right time of year to seed. So initially, definitely as quickly as possible, increase the life content in the soil, because it's only the life content in the soil will make it efficient to increase the organic matter content. It's not the carbon, just the carbon, it's the total organic matter content that's going to make the difference. Excuse the baby in the background. Once you've done that, I would then define the contour lines that you can plant your trees on. Boundaries, of course, especially wind-prone boundaries, reduce evaporation in midsummer and allow for shelter and shade and sun traps. So boundary shading with trees, giving you microclimate pasture, and then specific contour lines through the landscape to give you divisions of your pasture. And included in there are pioneer trees, support trees, and whatever long-term trees you want to be included. Now, you can select an area of the farm that you regularly crop with a forage harvester and bring it into a compost mix. Now, that's the only fresh component you need. Manure can be a little bit older, and brown material can be older. Right, so a wood chipper is very handy once you have trees because you can add the carbon component with wood chip. Manure you're going to have from the animals or any you bring in. Both of those don't have to be perfectly fresh, but really fresh green material. Now you can have a small area, half an acre or so, that you continuously crop off and you make your compost, check the beneficial soil life in the finished compost, and then convert it into compost tea and put that back on the area you're harvesting with your forage harvester, back on the pasture for production completely, back on the trees completely, back on your crop systems completely, but definitely back on the area where you're harvesting the green material for the compost. Now, you can, at the same time, increase the diversity of pasture seed as the fertility comes up. So you're upcycling your compost with your wood chip. When you're growing better trees, more diverse trees all the time, you're wood chipping those. You're growing better pasture all the time, you're diversifying that. You're spraying your compost tea back on the pasture. So you're kind of upcycling the quality of the inputs. The quality of your horse manure is going to increase as well, but all animal manures are going to increase in quality. And then you've got the bulk compost, which you can put on your crop gardens, where bulk compost tea and bulk compost, where you expect the large production taken off the ground. So there you go, that's my advice. And while you're in Yorkshire, go to Ripon, Yorkshire, Old Slellingford Farm, and check out Rachel's Food Forest. It's an awesome example of what can be done with simply working with the local regrowth and putting very diverse productive systems together. Rachel's Food Forest also has a Facebook page and a newsletter. There you go.
All right, with that, let's now move on to nuclear energy making a resurgence in the United States and finally, like, coming into the reality that we're now in 2025, not 1960. Because, and it'll be an interesting thing when we have Dylan and John on next month to talk about this resurgence. But Dylan works in the industry, and he's confirmed this, and many others who I know in the audience who work in the nuclear industry have confirmed this. When you walk into the most modern nuclear facilities in the United States, the technology is also the same as it was 50, 60 years ago. And you walk into 1965. You feel like you're in a 1965 movie in a nuclear plant. You know that technology has advanced since then, and there's some really interesting things going on with small-scale nuclear, thorium, many other things like that. And that means that there is movement in the right direction. It also means there's opportunity, especially for those who take some portion of their investments outside of the conservative approach into what maybe more alternative or more risk-based investing, thinking very long-term. And so there's some companies in that space that are worth looking at, and we have a question about two of those companies for John today from an audience member.
Hello, TSP. I've got a couple questions for you today. First one comes from Troy. He's asking about a couple nuclear energy stocks, Oklo and NuScale. Both of these companies are on the cutting edge of small modular nuclear reactors. Now, this is all the rage in terms of future energy development, and it's really the first big changes we've seen in the nuclear sector for, I don't know, probably 60 or maybe 80 years. So it is very exciting technology. And Troy is invested in both of these companies. And since he's asked this question, there's been a pretty substantial pullback in both of these companies' stock price. Now, that's to be expected because, you know, number one, this is new technology. Number two, these companies are in the nuclear industry, so that in and of itself is volatile. And then finally, you know, these stocks in particular have gotten rock star, you know, meme stock status. So volatility is definitely to be expected here. I wouldn't necessarily worry about the pullbacks. Personally, I don't own either of these. I do track them, but I'm far more of a conservative investor, Troy, than you are. And so if I was going to go into these, it would only be with at least at this rate, a very small percent of my overall investing portfolio. And having said that, I'm not anti-nuclear. In fact, I do have some, you know, pretty substantial investments broadly in nuclear energy and specifically up and down the supply chain. I want to be in a company that has a history of, you know, if not at least profitability, a very likely potential of near-term profitability. So in terms of my nuclear energy focus, number one, I'm heavily invested in traditional utility companies that have a lot of exposure to existing, up and running, you know, old school nuclear technology. That would be companies like Duke Energy or Entergy. And then number two, I'm invested in a non-regulated utility, a company called Constellation Energy. They're pretty much a pure nuclear energy play. And you may have heard of them because they've been in the news with working with hyperscalers, and they're trying to start up the Three Mile Island project. And then beyond utilities, I want to own companies that are profitable, that are in the supply chain itself. So I own a company called Centrus Energy. They're a nuclear refiner. And then from the mining side of things, I also own a company called Cameco, which is a Canadian uranium miner. In any case, to answer your question, the stocks you mentioned, I would not invest in them, but they are outside of my current risk tolerance. But as far as that overall electrification trade, absolutely, I'm all over it. And I think it has legs for, you know, at least the next decade. Also, your question is timely because on September 10th, myself and Dylan Allen, who's an expert on the nuclear energy industry, are going to be on Jack's show, and we're going to dedicate that whole episode to talking about the future of nuclear energy as well as investing opportunities. So tune in for that. And then our next question came from Zeb. He's asking about maxing out his Roth IRA. And just on a high level, yes, yes, yes. A Roth, whether it's a Roth IRA or a Roth component of a 401k, in my opinion, is always something you want to load up on, because while it doesn't give you an immediate tax advantage, it allows that money to grow tax-free forever. And forever's a long time. When you get to be my age, you really appreciate not only the miracle of compounding interest, but the double whammy of not having to pay taxes on the gains. He mentions in his question that he's maxing out his HSA. He's doing the 5% contribution to his 401k because his employer matches that. That's really good, Zeb. You're really checking off all the boxes there. And then he finishes up by asking, you know, if he wants to retire before age 60, is there something he should change in his investment strategy here? And Zeb, let me just step back here and saying, you're asking a really good question, but from a very wrong information perspective. Because all the information you provided me, you only mentioned your real true investment, which you're doing a $5 a day Bitcoin investment. That's investing that I can understand and that I can categorize. In terms of contributing to your HSA and your 401k and a Roth, well, that's really not investing. I mean, that's simply putting the money into retirement accounts that are tax advantaged. And that's a very good thing to do, but it's not an investment in and of itself. Those are just tax advantaged vehicles. So should you change what you're investing in? Well, you know, beyond Bitcoin, I have no idea what you're investing in. Okay, I'm not being a smart aleck here. I'm just trying to point out a common misconception that I hear from people all the time. When you contribute to a retirement account, that's not investing. That's simply making the money available for investing. You know, what do you invest in within that account? I don't know, right? Could be foreign stocks, small cap, large cap. Maybe you're just sitting in a government bond fund. Without specific information, I really couldn't possibly guide or direct you in any way. But hey, if you have specifics, feel free to reach out to me. I appreciate all the questions. Until next time, this is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealth Studying Podcast.
Good stuff, and I'm really looking forward to that interview next month on nuclear power resurgence. We're going to need it. We've needed it. Life would have been better if we did it a long time ago. It's like the tree thing, you know. The best time to plant it was 10 years ago. The next best time to plant it is today. There is a reality coming of energy demand from artificial intelligence, and that demand is such that it has to happen. So we're finally going to do what we always could have done, which is if you want carbon-free energy, you want nuclear power. I have said for years, I don't believe in the global warming hysteria, but when the global warming hysteria people tell me all about their hysteria, and I say, then are you pro-clean, modern nuclear energy, and they say no, I say, then you don't actually believe what you're saying. You've bought into the Marxist-level lies of clean energy, which doesn't work. I am not for getting rid of wind and solar and things like that. I think there's a lot of potential there, but you can't run the world on it. Not now, and you won't be able to do it in 20 years. We couldn't do it 20 years ago. I said we couldn't do it in 20 more years. It's been 17 years, not quite 20. But I said that in 2008 when I started the show, publicly on the record. And in the next 3 years, we're not getting there either, are we? But we can run the world on nuclear. Nuclear can be the bridge to cleaner forms of energy if they ever get it right. But the reality is modern nuclear is freaking amazing. And there's so many opportunities in nuclear energy to produce energy that is much cleaner, has very little actual high-level dangerous waste, and there are ways to deal with that waste that are incredibly proven and safe. In France, and I don't really like using France as an example, but when they're doing something better than us, they have modern nuclear energy facilities like right in the middle of cities, and nothing happens. I don't think we should do that because they can become a target for terrorism, especially if you co-locate them directly in the backyard of like 500,000 people. Okay, I get it. But we can do this in a way that makes sense. We absolutely can. And we do not need to use 1965 technology to do it. We don't need to worry about Fukushima's. That was a 1960s plant. We don't need to worry about Three Mile Island. That's a 1960s plant. You see what I'm saying? Like, what other technology from 1965 are we using today? I mean, 1965, everybody was using freaking LP records and 8-track tapes. Come on, no one had a VCR. Really, no one had a microwave in a home. A television set had tubes in it that looked like light bulbs, and you went down to the hardware store to replace them when they burned out. Most people in America still were on black and white televisions, even though we had color shows. We were still on black and white TVs for most of the country. Telephones were bolted to walls. Can we please accept that, like, you know, 60 years have gone by and we haven't done anything to make this better? And we certainly can. Let's do that. Anyway, let's go ahead now and hear about a really cool thing. How to turn a new tax advantage that sounds like it's only for big giant companies into something you can actually use just by how you call a thing, as long as you call the right thing the thing.
Hey everyone, Matthew Sersley of AgoristTaxAdvice.com here to talk about how to save money on taxes. Now, most of my favorite kinds of tax strategies, the ones I come back to over and over, are those where you don't have to actually spend any more money to save on taxes. You just change how you're spending it or how you categorize it. And that's why I'm always looking for things like taking personal expenses and, if possible, making them 100% legitimate business expenses, so they become a write-off. But there's another strategy that's gotten a lot better recently that is in the same category of you just need to define it the right way, and it can result in big tax savings. I'm here talking today about the R&D tax credit, a way to take expenses you're already deducting and put an additional credit on top. The only extra work is making sure to fill out your tax return the right way. So what is the R&D tax credit, and why haven't most people heard of it? Well, R&D stands for research and development, and that phrase throws a lot of people off. You know, most people think of labs, scientists, big pharma, Silicon Valley, venture funding, and those guys almost always qualify for this, but there's a good chance you do too in your business. The IRS definition is much broader than it sounds. If you're developing or improving a product, a process, a technique, software, or formula, and if there is technical uncertainty involved, and if you're using trial and error or some other method of experimentation, then you probably qualify. It doesn't have to be groundbreaking. It doesn't have to succeed. You just have to be trying to solve a technical or scientific problem and don't have a clear answer up front. So, some things that do count. A distillery testing new ratios and processes to create a self-stable canned cocktail. A welder modifying jigs and fixtures to reduce heat distortion in custom metal parts. Or a consultant designing and testing a custom database integration between a legacy system and cloud software. None of these people are in a lab, but they're all solving real-world technical problems through experimentation, and that's R&D. Now, some things that just never qualify. Any sort of market research or customer feedback. Any sort of style, packaging, or cosmetic changes. Although, if the packaging changes are, like, to make sure something survives shipping, that could qualify. Anything involving content creation or branding. And anything requiring routine or administrative work with no uncertainty. If there's no technical challenge or no experimentation, it's not R&D. Now, the great thing about this is you're already deducting these costs, but you get a tax credit on top of it. And by the way, many states have these tax credits too, if they have a state income tax. So make sure you're checking that out. So that's money off your tax bill because it's a credit. It's not just your taxable income. It's one of the few places in the tax code where you get rewarded twice for the same thing. And don't forget, it's not just the cost of the material you get the credit on. You also get it on the salary of the person working on the thing, including, and I see a lot of people forget this, your own salary if you're self-employed in an S-Corp. And like I said, it's gotten even better in the big, beautiful bill, because it used to be you took this credit and you had to spread it out over 5 years. Now you get it 100% in the year you earn it. And even better, it's retroactive. So it counts for expenses in 2022, 2023, and 2024. And you can amend those returns now and go back and claim the full credit now. That's real cash from work you already did. I have a personal friend. He's not a client, but he's got a business. He didn't know about R&D credits, so he never claimed them. He's going back and he's amended his 2022 and 2023 returns, and he's getting about $45,000 back. Now, he's in a business doing millions of dollars in revenue a year. That's not necessarily typical or what you should expect, but it's, for most people, thousands of dollars tax-free cash back. Let's go to some examples, and just hypothetically, let's say there's a guy who's a podcaster with an audience in the homesteading and prepper space. He wants to teach people how to grow their own food and be more self-sufficient, and he has really gotten into mushrooms recently. So he starts experimenting. He tests different humidity levels, different grow mediums, sterilization processes. He does different test racks. Maybe he moves them up and down. Maybe he tries them different places in the house to see if that affects things. He checks, differences in lights. You fail a bunch of times, or maybe you succeed, but you succeed better in other times. You tweak the process. You try again. Now, you're not selling mushrooms, but you are building content about it. You're spending time and money developing a process. You're documenting it. You're sharing results. You're doing trial and error work. So that almost certainly is a qualified R&D activity. Your equipment, your testing, your salary for the time you spent building and experimenting, those expenses don't just get deducted from your business. They count towards a tax credit on top of that deduction. Another random example, I don't know where I'm coming up with this, but let's say it's a different podcaster running a show about off-grid living and homesteading. She raises sheep in some really rough terrain in Tennessee, and she's fighting to find a better system to keep them in and to keep the predators out. So, and she's got this mobile fencing that she's got to move around every time because she doesn't necessarily know where she wants the permanent fencing, but it's rocky, it's hilly, it's hard to put the stuff in. So she starts testing a lot of things, different materials, different fencing, different ways to anchor them into different types of soil, different post spacings, different ways to handle the slope. That's all trial and error. That's all real world problem solving. And then you move on to the electrical side because you want an electric fence. You're testing different solar chargers, different grounding configurations, different voltage outputs, in different weather conditions, how to set up the fence so it shocks the seat when it's supposed to, but doesn't short out during the thunderstorms. And that's not plug-and-play stuff. You're applying agricultural science, electrical testing, and hands-on experimentation to develop a system that works in your conditions. And you're not just doing that for your own animals, although that would be enough, but now you're doing it to teach others the process, the results you've learned. That's R&D. That's deductible already, but again, that would also qualify for the additional tax credit on top of that. So here's the bottom line. A lot of us are probably already doing R&D and don't know it, don't know to ask a CPA or attorney about it, don't know how to document it. But if you're solving technical problems in your business, especially if it's true experimentation, especially if you can show sometimes you succeed and sometimes you fail, you owe it to yourself to find out whether those costs qualify. Because if you do, you're leaving potentially huge tax credits behind. These are not refundable, but if you owe taxes, you can get a refund on this, again, for stuff you've already done back in 2022, 2023, or 2024. If you want to learn more about this and other tax deductions, please head over to agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP. Grab my free book I put together on possible business deductions. And as always, remember, the IRS doesn't deserve your fear. They don't deserve your mother, your money either. See you next time.
So I think I'm going to listen to that one like two or three more times. Then I'm going to take all the things that I think work for this that are part of my business or could be part of my business. And then I'm going to go on a deep exploration of discovery using two separate AI units, Gemini and GPT. And I think that this may be usable in 2026 for the Survival Podcast and for many of you as well. There's a lot of great ideas Matthew had there. But again, it always comes back to, but how does it apply to me? I will be honest. I completely wrote this one off. I said, oh, that's great. I do think that makes sense. It will lead to innovation and what have you, but it probably doesn't apply to me. I hadn't dug into this one enough yet. So thanks, Matt, for pointing that out. Now let's hear from Doc Bones on road rash.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. This week we hear from John, who writes, "What is the best self-care for road rash? A recent bicycle road crash left me with road rash on the right shoulder, right elbow, and upper forearm, and up and right knee. Wow. What is the best self-care treatment, and what are the best supplies to store for larger area scrapes?" John in Moorpark. John, first, let's define road rash for those people that aren't familiar with it. Road rash is a skin injury best characterized as a friction burn caused by abrasion with an asphalt, concrete, or cement road surface. It often occurs as a result of cycling, motorcycling, skateboarding, inline skating, and other mishaps. When you fall during one of these activities, you hit the pavement, but you don't stop immediately. Indeed, your momentum drags you along the paved surface, creating friction. Road rash can be a major issue when the burn is deeper, especially if it also covers a large amount of your body surface area, which it might have in your case. Road rash damages your skin surface, allowing gravel, debris, and other dirt to lodge in the burned skin. And like all burns, experts classify road rash severity based on how deep the burn goes. The severity levels are superficial, which affects the epidermis, just the outermost level of your skin. The partial thickness burns, these burns affect the epidermis and the dermis that's just beneath. Superficial partial thickness burns only affect the upper dermis. Deep partial thickness burns cause damage deep into the lower dermis and are certainly more serious. And then, of course, there are full thickness burns. These burns damage the epidermis, dermis, and the fat layer underneath your skin. In very severe cases, road rash can extend beyond the fat layer underneath your skin, damaging tissues like muscle and bone underneath. Road rash can cause pain, as you can imagine, superficial, as you don't have to imagine, John, actually, you experienced it. Superficial and partial thickness road rash burns are very painful. Full thickness road rash burns, interestingly enough, destroy the nerves, so they may not hurt as much, but the tissues around the edges can. You'll notice skin color changes as well. Light-skinned people have red or pinkish skin with superficial road rash. Darker-skinned individuals may develop a reddish tinge to their skin. It may also appear lighter as it heals. Lighter-skinned people may have partial thickness burns that look a darker red or a reddish brown. Full-thickness burns, well, they can have varied effects that can make their skin darker and charred-looking or a pale ashy gray. Blistering is another possibility. Superficial partial thickness road rash can cause your skin to blister like a thermal burn. These burns fill with a yellowish fluid, and it's normal for them to eventually break open, usually on their own. Road rash, especially severe cases, takes a lot of physical force for you to slide on a paved surface, as you can imagine. The longer the distance you slide on the paved surface, or the faster you move doing so, the worse the burn will be. Severe road rash can cause many complications. They can include infections. The physical force it takes to get road rash can also embed all sorts of contaminants into your skin. That makes it easy for road rash to become infected. Traumatic tattooing Embedded debris and foreign objects stay behind in your skin as road rash heals. When they remain visible beneath your skin, even after the injury heals, well, that's traumatic tattooing. And of scarring, of course. Road rash, especially full-thickness burns from it, can cause significant tissue damage, and deeper burns can take much longer to heal and more likely to scar. Now, there are severe or life-threatening complications that can occur from road rash. Like flame or scalding burns, severe road rash can put a strain on your body systems. Large partial thickness and full thickness burns can cause life-threatening complications like shock due to fluid loss from the burn, blood loss from related injuries, or both. Hypothermia, severe skin damage disrupts how your body regulates its internal temperature. Organ failure, waste products left behind when tissues break down can strain your kidneys when you try to filter the waste out. These are some serious things that can happen. So how is road rash treated? Like with all burns, the treatment for road rash depends a little bit. Superficial road rash burns need minimal or no treatment, really, other than cleaning the area. Run cold water over the burn for a few minutes immediately after it happens. Make sure there's no grit or dirt in the damaged skin, and cover the burn with a sterile bandage or a clean cloth. Make sure the coverings you use aren't too tight. If they are, it can affect how your burn heals. You can use over-the-counter pain medicines like acetaminophen, that's Tylenol, ibuprofen, Advil, or naproxen, which is Aleve, to help with the inflammation and the pain. You may also be able to self-treat partial thickness road burns if they're small enough. A good guideline is whether you can cover them with your hand. If they're larger than your hand, they need professional care. And full thickness burns always require expert medical attention. John, you asked about supplies. So besides managing the pain, care will involve cleaning with antiseptics. Your burn can get infected if there's any debris, dirt, or grit in the wound. Your burn will need cleaning and removal of any dead tissue, that's called debridement, to avoid complications. Betadine, Hibiclens, and hydrogen peroxide are some options. Bandaging. Partial thickness and full thickness burns damage your natural armor, your skin, meaning that it can't do its job of keeping things like germs outside. Bandages are a stand-in to protect your body when your skin can't. Have non-stick bandages like Telfa pads and gauze rolls with medical tape around in good supply. Just don't roll it too tight around the burn itself. Surgery? Well, deeper burns may take too long to heal on their own without surgery to help, and so some people will require things like skin grafting to help the burn heal. Antibiotics, of course, some suggest taking antibiotics like cefalexin or clindamycin to help treat or prevent infection. So what can you expect with regards to recovery? The shallower the road rash burn, the less time your recovery should take. Superficial burns will heal in a couple of days or so. Deeper burns will take weeks, maybe more, to get all the way back to normal. Of course, road rash can be just one consequence of a major fall and slide on pavement. Joint damage and fractures are also possibilities and have to be dealt with. You want to prevent road rash from happening in the first place, and there are several things you can do to prevent road rash, or at least lower your chance of getting it. They include wearing the right clothing for the activity. Certain types of clothing are made specifically to protect motorcyclists, for example, from road rash and other injuries. Don't neglect other kinds of safety gear. Elbows and knee pads and helmets, well, these can protect you from road rash if you're rollerblading, skateboarding, or mountain biking. Traveling at safe speeds and giving the road your full attention and being aware of your surroundings can all spare you from serious injury. This is perhaps the most important factor in keeping you from getting into trouble. I hope this helps. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
All right, so just real quick, I'll tell you what I learned about road rash when I was like 16 years old. I was in a car with some friends, and the guy driving was an idiot. I won't get to the whole story, but basically we ended up on the roof. We slid about 280 feet down a hill on the roof of this car, kind of spinning around. And we all had fairly superficial injuries. None of us even went to the hospital. I probably had the most just based on where I was sitting. I was in the passenger seat, and my face literally blew out the passenger window. When the car rolled, I was on the high side, and I smacked the window and cracked it. And then when it came down, it blew out. And then it seemed like it was probably a second or two, it felt like forever that that car was still moving. And when we got out, I had glass cuts on my both hands, but they were like really fine glass cuts and some scrapes and some bumps. And one of the guys that was in the back seat actually got hit with a bowling ball in the back of the head that was in the, it was a Ford Escort station wagon. So there was a bowling ball back there that hit him, and he had a bit of a knot, but everybody was okay. I didn't realize until I got home and took my pants off how serious the one of the road rash things was that I got on my knee. It hurt a little bit, but not much. And there was a little tiny hole in I was wearing jeans, and there was a little tiny hole in my jeans. I mean, something about the size of like a BB, like a regular from a BB gun. But when I took my pants off, I had a huge road rash, and like deep, you could actually see a little bit behind the patella of the knee on kind of the outside. I still have a scar to this day, and I was like 16, 17 years old then. And what is it? I'm in my 50s now, and I still have a pretty gnarly scar from that. What I learned is that road rash can transfer the friction through something because there was no hole in the roof. So you had the roof, then you had the liner, right? Then you had my jeans, then you had my knee. And the thing that took the brunt of the friction was the thing that had the least resistance to it, human flesh. It's just a little aside there. Anyway, it can be pretty serious with larger road rash injuries, so take Bones' words there all to heart. Now let's talk about what I want to talk about today. I'm going to be brief, even for me. With this one, because there's no sense in continuously rehashing this. But I have told you guys from the very beginning of this Russia-Ukraine conflict, when this started, the day it happened, I came on air and I said the following. Now that this has happened, because of all the stupidity that led up to it, the best case scenario is Russia takes the Donbass, which is two provinces, Donetsk and Luhansk. The current peace deal that is on the table from Russia's end is, yeah, we want that. And we'll give everything else back. Now, what you're hearing in the media is more stupidity. Russia wants land that they didn't even take. It's ridiculous. They want everything they have plus what they... No, they do not. Russia took a huge swath of land, and the little pieces of these two provinces that are still controlled by Ukraine are tiny compared to all the other land Russia has. What Russia's saying is, we took these two provinces. Come on, just be honest, we did. After we took them, which we did in like the first couple weeks of the war, we ran an election. We ran an election. We let the people in those regions vote. They could either become independent or part of Russia. Over 90% of them voted to become part of Russia. The people who live there have spoken. We want these provinces. In return, we took this land all the way from the border of the Donbass all the way to Crimea. The whole coastline. We have hundreds of square miles that we control. We'll give it all up. We want that little piece of the two provinces that we did this for in the first place, and get the hell out of the little piece of Kursk you guys are in. And then you can have your peacekeepers. This is a very reasonable offer for Russia to make. It's a very reasonable offer under the circumstances. But Putin never had to invade. I'm not going to get into that. Ukraine called. Let's get into a little bit. Let's do the timeline of how this happened. The Ukrainians elect. First, they kicked the guy out and said that the election was fraud. Okay? And so they got rid of him the first time he ran for president. He then, after that president got the term, he ran again and was elected in 2010. Viktor Yanukovych is the guy that I'm talking about. He was elected, and this guy was very popular when he was elected, and his goal was to have good relations with Russia and good relations with the EU. He wanted both. Well, we didn't want that. We wanted it to be EU, so we put pressure on the European Union to put pressure on Yanukovych, do our deal at the exclusion of Russia, or you don't get the deal. In the end, even though the Ukrainian parliament, who was in the bag for us, agreed to the deal, Yanukovych put the brakes on the deal. And so we're not doing this because we're not writing Russia out. We're a small country. We have Russia on one border. We have the European Union on the other. We need good relations with both. There's no reason for us to be adversarial to Russia. Well, Lindsey Graham, John McCain, A.B. Klobuchar, and some others all got involved in a movement to get rid of him, and they made it look like a populist movement. They got the parliament in the Ukraine to say basically he's got to go. Now, here's the thing. The deal, yes, was approved by the Ukrainian parliament, and the justification to get rid of him was, but he stopped the deal. That would be like if we had our Congress pass something and our president vetoed it. It's the same thing. And then we're like, okay, we're going to get rid of the president now. And we're going to do it at the behest of foreign governments, because that's what happened. So they ran this color revolution. Yanukovych went to Russia. He's still there. He's in exile. They had sentenced him to bullshit, and he's going to go to prison if he ever comes out of Russia, basically. He's like, he's over there hanging out with Snowden. While this was all going on, from 2014 forward, the people of the Donbas, who were very pro-Russian because it's Russia, okay? It is Russia. When the Soviet Union was established, and they brought in what they called satellite republics, Ukraine, Lithuania, Georgia, Estonia, etc. When they brought those into the Soviet Union, in many instances, and specifically with Ukraine, they extended those republics back into Russia, meaning the Donbas, these two provinces, were always Russia. And when they created the new version of Ukraine that you know with its borders, which wasn't even a country until the 1920s, it was a territory, an ungoverned territory that was, you know, raided and partially controlled by the Poles, the Hungarians, the Russians, etc. at all for many, many years. It was like this frontier territory. And they created this modern version of Ukraine, and they put two Russian provinces inside the borders. This was a Soviet mechanism of control of the republics because they did have autonomy, kind of like we do. Like, yes, we have the federal government, but also the state of Texas or Florida or Georgia or Washington or Oregon or California has certain autonomy. And that was true in the Soviet Union, even though they told you it wasn't in school. So they wanted loyalists inside these republics. So this is the consequences of fucking around with borders instead of letting them naturally establish. So they put their own country inside there. This means that most of the people there to this day, 100 plus years later, are still Russians. They see themselves as Russia. They have Russian pride. They fly the Russian flag. They speak the Russian language. They cook Russian food. They're extremely devout Eastern Orthodox as a general portion of the population. They are Russians. They were pissed when we, the United States, along with the EU, deposed the president that they voted for. And they were like, fuck this. We don't want this. And a separatist movement started overnight. Realizing we were losing control, we stepped in. We negotiated without even letting them be part of it between us and and Russia, something called the Minsk Accords. And then the Ukrainians like, yeah, we'll honor those. And that those accords were these two provinces get even more autonomy than a typical province in Ukraine. They can basically self-govern as long as they stay with Ukraine, and we'll leave them alone. And then immediately, the Ukrainians started shelling and bombing locations inside the Donbas. This is what happened. For a period of 8 years, the Ukraine government prosecuted a civil war in the Donbas against its own people. That's how we got here. That's how we got here. Now, where are we today? Well, Ukraine has lost like 60,000 soldiers to fatalities. That's what Zelensky said like a week ago. And about 300,000 is casualties, meaning they were injured and can't return to battle, but they're alive. Well, what came out yesterday, a hacker group from Russia penetrated the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense network and obtained a list of how many soldiers the Ukraine says they lost. They're either dead confirmed or in combat missing, which means they're probably dead. 1.7 million people. 1.7 million men. Again, that would be equivalent to 14 million American males killed. As I promised in the intro, I said I would find out, well, how, like, not just how many men are there in America, right? Because it would be equivalent to us losing 14.45 million is the actual number based on our population being 340 million. But what I looked up is, but how many American males are there between the age of 18 and 40? The answer, 23.7 million. 14.5 million of 23 million? That's more than half. Pretty much walk around in America anywhere, look at dudes and go, that dude's over 18, under 40, and find two of them, one of them's gone. Half. Half of your premium demographic. Now, the number of actual people who have been seriously injured to the point where they are crippled in some way, incapacitated in some way, is not the 300,000 Zelensky claims. Now, I don't have the proof of this like we do for this 1.7 million, but the sources I have tell me it is closer to a million men. So that's another million. So of what you have left, a million of those are disabled. And again, adjust that to the U.S., and you're looking at something more like 4 to 5 million. So you go out in the streets and look around and eliminate half the men, 18 to 40, and then of what's left, about 30 to 40% of those are physically infirm, disfigured, damaged, serious PTSD. What's left of your country now? This is Ukraine. This cannot keep going. This cannot keep going. I don't care. You can't buy life. You can't bring back the fucking dead. We did this. This is why I'll give some Trump some leniency here. He had not a single fucking thing to do with the bullshit we pulled from about the year to about 1998, honestly. From about 1998 to 2014, the bullshit we pulled in that period is the cause of this. It's very similar to what I said about Nixon doesn't really get the blame for leaving the gold standard because Johnson fucked up what was left of it, and by the time Nixon took over, there wasn't anything to do but call time of death. It's kind of like that. Now, could he have done more in his first term to turn the tide? Probably, but he was too busy dealing with bullshit like the Clinton's Russiagate crap and being impeached multiple times and all of the freaking hysteria because Orange Man bad. So I'll give him a little bit of leeway in that now this is not easy to fix. You can't do it on day one. And one thing the guy does that's really stupid is overpromise. Of course, he's a politician. He knows how to get elected. And that's how you get elected. You overpromise. My view is, again, we're on the path to peace, and Ukraine is nowhere in the position of power that you're being told, and this bullshit, but Russia's, Putin's attacking civilians. Guys, I want you to just stop being emotional. Stop pretending it's 1978 and the Cold War's going on. Stop it. And I want you to think for a minute. To what end? To what end? Why would Putin specifically, like, bomb apartment complexes? He's a madman, he's a killer, he's a murderer, come on. In the end, he's a politician. He's a president of a country. He's in the middle of a war. He wants to win the war. This doesn't help you win the war. It's a funny thing. When two nations go to war and they're right next to each other, civilians become casualties. It happens. In fact, in the history of war, you've been better off a soldier than a civilian if the war is in your country, which it is. This has to end. It's going to end. And I'm going to tell you something else that you're not going to like if you hate Trump. Without Trump, it would go on another year or two. It will go on until there's no one left to send into the cannon fodder. But there's not many left. Because the ones that didn't go, most of them are rich and they bought their way out or they ran away and they hid. But even those guys are getting swept up in these things now. You paid somebody off? That wasn't me. Too bad. Get on a bus. It is one of the sickest things that the United States has ever put its thumb on. Think about that, because we have some real scars in our history. This is probably the bloodiest, nastiest one of them all. With that, I do want to wrap things up. If you have any doubt about this, I'm going to put a link. And again, the link will go to Russia Today. But the story is a member of the Ukrainian parliament saying we lost generations of men here. Not Putin. Not Poroshenko, right? Not any of the Russian or Belarusian mouthpieces. A member of the Ukrainian parliament. And by the way, when the TV tells you, but the Ukrainians don't want to make the deal, bullshit, that's another lie. The latest polls out of Ukraine, and they're probably weighted to the advantage of the West, and they don't look, work even well for that. 69% of Ukrainians want the war ended immediately. Just over. We don't care. This is the thing. The person that lives in Kyiv doesn't give a fuck about the Donbass and never did. But we do, because we want to control things. Here, you want to know what I think we really did here? We got both sides to kill each other. Because, oh, that's fun. We've weakened Ukraine. And we've weakened Russia. And we didn't lose a single American life. Yay us. God, we are sorry pieces of crap in so many ways. It's not the America I want to be. I want to be America that stands for peace before everything else. I don't know if we'll ever get there. But any movement towards it, it makes sense. Anyway, with that, if you guys like my show and you want to help support us, one of the ways you can do that is do your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. I got a bunch of stuff in the show notes for you today from that. Earlier this week, I brought you the Easley Impact Socket Set. This is a great set of sockets. Chrome Vanadium, blacked out, really great stuff. Super heavy duty, super good price. The company itself just makes great stuff. I'm not going to say it's Snap-on quality, but it is like Craftsman Husky level quality, at least, maybe a little better for less money, and that is a good deal. I also brought you guys the Thermal Maven Instant Read Thermometer. It belongs in your kitchen if you don't have one already. It is already one of the best-selling items of the year, and I only brought it to you guys a few months ago. And it is like the number three best-selling product on T-Spaz, and number one's my book, right? So there's only one item that actually sold better this year than that product, and there's a reason for it. Also, the Anker Soundproof waterproof Bluetooth speakers, the pairing ones, they're on sale again. They're on a deal of the day again, so I put them in there. And then the Olatins titanium scalpels, man, I love these little gadgets. I really do. They're just some of the coolest little cutting tools available. They are super compact, super well made, and they use standard surgical blades, so they're super cheap to keep blades replacing them. I'd say they cost about the same for, you know, a scalpel blade doesn't cost really any different than like a razor knife blade, like your typical razor blades, because they're made in such quantity. But you can always help us out no matter what when you do your online shopping at tspaz.com. And last but not least, please consider picking up a copy of my book, Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life. Remember, if you don't design your life, you'll live the life that was designed for you by someone else. That is not the way to liberty, freedom, self-sufficiency, self-reliance, independence. It isn't. With that, hope you guys enjoy it. I will catch you next week with a couple episodes before I disappear on vacation. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.